It's The Wonky Show. Manifestos are out. We'll look at what's being promised. There's a big new survey on the student experience. We'll dive into the detail. And students are flirting with staff. Or are they? It's all coming up.
If a young woman and an older man have some kind of, like, working relationship, there's always an assumption that they're shagging. And we need to move away from that.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to separate the signals from the noise, as ever, three fantastic guests. In Cambridge, Jonathan Grant is director at Different Angles. Jonathan, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, Jim, I'm going to cheat a bit because I'm just back from 2 weeks in Canada, which must be my highlight of the year for me to date. The first week was work, where we launched a report on innovation accelerators for Alberta Innovates, and I hope a summary of that will soon appear on Wonky. However, the real highlight was the play element, a week-long road trip from Calgary to Vancouver. I saw bears, caught fish, hiked snow-topped mountains and had a fab time, which I'm still basking in.
Well, I think we're all very jealous about that. In Exeter, Alex Stanley is Education Officer at Exeter Students Guild and Vice President Higher Education Elect at the National Union of Students. Alex, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I'm not sure I can top the last one, but tonight we have our annual teaching awards, which myself and other sabbatical officers will be hosting. So I'm looking forward to what should be a fun evening and my last big event before I move on to the NUS.
Well, there we go. And in Aldershot this week, Sunday Blake is Associate Editor at Wonky. Sunday, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week kind of refers to last week, because I was off from Wonky, and I went to three weddings and one funeral. So almost made a Richard Curtis film. But I came back to work on Monday. No, Tuesday I came back to work because I was recovering Monday from the flights. But yeah, no, it's really nice to be back at work and to dive back into what is a really exciting couple of weeks or a few weeks for us.
So yes, we start this week with manifestos. This week we've seen documents from the Tories, the Lib Dems, the Greens, Plaid is there somewhere, and Labour's is on its way Sunday.
Yes, yeah. Although at the time of recording, it's not out in full. So we're hoping that there's not going to be some sort of like big announcement coming out that we could have had a really good podcast discussion on. But we can be fairly sure that there are no sort of large rabbits in the hat for higher education and students based on sort of what's already been briefed or announced or suggested on the campaign trail. The Conservatives, of course, have their famous pledge to crack down on 13% of low quality degrees. And we also found out this week that new money for policing would come from raising the cost of student visas by £120. So that would be a total of £612.50, and removing the student and student dependent discount on the immigration health surcharge. So that would bring it up to £1,035 a year. The Lib Dem manifesto has loads of big commitments for HE. So a full review of funding in the next parliament, the reintroduction of maintenance grants, statutory duty of care, if people have been following the debate around that, a return to Erasmus. The Greens on Wednesday also promised to advocate for a maintenance grant and Erasmus, as well as scrapping tuition fees and working towards a long-term plan to cancel all student debt, although I don't think that that has been costed yet.
Well, interesting stuff, Jonathan. Has anything stood out for you in what we've seen so far?
Yeah, well, Jim, I sort of, with the jet lag, I woke up early this morning and went down a bit of a data rabbit hole. So I took the Conservative, Lib Dem and Green manifestos and just put the word university and universities in it. And universities are mentioned 9 times in the Conservative one, 8 times in the Lib Dems, and 3 times in the Greens. But when you look at the sentiment of that, the Conservatives one are all sort of exclusively neutral or negative, and both the other two parties are broadly positive, seeing universities as areas that can help drive forward to the country. Interestingly, I then went back to 2019, and the Conservatives mentioned universities 15 times, and they were all again in a positive light. The other thing I thought was interesting was that free speech didn't come up, or it did only come up in the Conservative manifesto once, but that was talking about the Freedom of Speech Act, which obviously they've implemented. So what do I take from that? I think basically it says to me that universities are not on the radar in this election. And I think that chimes to a degree with Public First's recent polling on education, which reflects that universities, again, are not in the public priorities in the broader sense.
Hmm. Interesting. Alex, what was kind of in there for students? Anything?
Depends which manifesto you're looking at. There's a lot of good stuff in the Liberal Democrats manifesto, as Sunday pointed out. I think the pledge to bring back maintenance grants for disadvantaged students would be a real step in the right direction. But who disadvantaged students actually are is a really interesting discussion, I think, with the cost of living crisis and the sort of normalisation of financial difficulty for a lot of students. That's a provision that would need to be expanded to as many students as possible. And whether the Lib Dems have the costings for that, I think, is a very different question. And it's also worth saying we all not know what happened the last time students put their faith into the Liberal Democrats. Conservatives manifesto really worries me too, I have to say, particularly when it comes to the hostile environment and the sort of purging of international student rights, you know, visa fees going up, the student discount on the immigration health surcharge going too, which would cost up to 30% more for international students. And at a time where our sector is primarily funded by sort of postgraduate and international student fees, it's not only moral reasons that make the Conservatives' aggression towards international students wrong, but also the fact that they're hugely damaging our sector in pushing so hard against them.
And obviously there was completely to the other end of the spectrum, the Greens on immigration, wasn't it, where there was quite a bit on making the NHS completely free and so on in the Greens.
No, absolutely. It was a very Corbyn-style higher education system that the Greens are pushing for, and immigration was very much a part of that. A really positive manifesto, a lot of what we saw in the Greens. It would cost a lot of money and taxes would go up for a lot of people. But I mean, the reality is the Greens probably won't be getting more than, I'd say 2 to 4 MPs. So I think that has to be taken with a pinch of salt.
And I don't want to come across as a defender of the Conservative manifesto at all. But what I thought was interesting was that it felt like there was a shift away from the sort of culture war attack on universities to more of a technocratic issues. And whilst I absolutely agree with what Alex just said, it's probably not surprising that the focus for the Conservatives is around immigration and student immigration, and also around apprenticeships and quality, or perceived quality or lack of quality, of courses. And to a degree, I think we shouldn't knock that away, because I think both of those are reasonable issues that we should be willing to engage in.
Mm. Sunday, obviously, to some extent, we were kind of predicting that higher education wouldn't feature in a big way in the manifestos. But there's a whole bunch of stuff that would impact higher education and students across the manifestos. There's stuff on health and, you know, all sorts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I do think that the approach to higher education is underwhelming across the board. I think we need to remember how integrated, higher education is into other areas of policy development. And like you said, housing, immigration, healthcare. I think Alex mentioned migration. Well, everyone's mentioned migration. The hard sort of grind of turning around our skills, right through education to make sure that, you know, we have the right skills to grow the economy, that both Starmer and Sunak were sort of like repeating over and over again in the ITV debate, you know, just as important as getting this right in universities is also getting the country's infrastructure right around that. So things like transport, things like housing infrastructure, that's what our student graduates will graduate into and need to work in and to offer their skilled knowledge to. And that's pretty essential. I think that, you know, this, I get very frustrated because I think very big picture. So, you know, when we have the Tories talking about low quality degrees or like bad graduate outcomes, I'm always like, okay, but what is the infrastructure environment that these graduates are expected to use those degrees within, if that makes sense? And I'm not just picking on the Tories for this, because while the Green manifesto was brilliant when it came to education and, you know, fees are funded and you know, they sort of, and whether or not you agree with their pledges or not, they had put a lot of thought into it. There was copious amounts on things like housing, but there was nothing on student accommodation or on sort of like more around like HMOs that graduates would be working in. So yeah, I read through the manifestos just last night because I only came back to work Tuesday. But I do think that while there's not that much direct HE kind of pledges, there's a lot that us as a sector can take on board that is going to impact our sector, it's going to impact our students, that's then going to impact the ability for our students to use their degrees going forward.
Mm. Jonathan, I guess, you know, sometimes manifestos are about setting out an exciting new future. And then, you know, quite often, actually, manifestos are about reflecting back to the public what the problems are and then having a plan to solve them. And it definitely feels like we're in a kind of era of the latter. Why is it that do you think that, you know, to the extent to which students and universities are facing problems, they haven't manifested in the manifestos as things that need to be solved?
Because so much else is broken as well, would be my short and unhelpful response. And I think it's, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at public services, the NHS, the security agenda, economic stagnation, those are going to be the issues which any government, you would think, is going to prioritize coming in. So, you know, I think what's happened is that within the sector, we understand all the challenges we face. We got good sort of views on what needs to be done. But the reality is, in the first 2 years of a new government, I don't think we're going to get much of an ear. And I think that's really, you know, I'm not defending that, but I think that's just reality in a sad sense. I think it's notable, but of the three manifestos we've had so far, there is nothing on student funding, I mean, or on university funding, on how to stop universities going bust. I also think it's notable, if you remember Sue Gray's shit list of the things that could hit an incoming Labour government, universities are on that. So the fact that we're not on the agenda at the moment, but we may find ourselves on the agenda in quite, you know, stark terms if a number of universities start going under financially in the next 12 months. Obviously not something we want, but it's not a implausible scenario. But at the end of the day, Jim, to answer your question, I just think there's so much that is broken in the UK at the moment that universities are not going to be in the top 10. And it's going to take a number of years for us to get on that radar. So at the end of the day, that means we've got to address these issues ourselves within the sector. I guess the big change could be, assuming we see a change of government, is that the tone will change and that will be advantageous.
But Jonathan, is there a problem with the way that the sector kind of talks about itself? So, I mean, you know, for example, we'll come on to the HEPI Advanced HE Student Academic Experience Survey later, but, you know, there's various ways that you can read that survey. And one way to read it is that things are getting better and everything's rosy in the higher education garden. And Vivian Stern, Chief Executive of UUK this morning, was kind of tweeting to that end. Now, my sense is that governments don't tend to fix problems in sectors that are saying everything's great.
So I saw that tweet. And I think that's the real politique of it, if you like. But at the same time, there is no money and HE ain't going to get any money. So there's probably little damage in the short term from that positive sentiment coming from Universities UK. I absolutely agree with you, Jim. I think that the narrative around the purpose, and, you know, I've written extensively on this, around the purpose of universities has to change. And it's not a funding narrative. It's a narrative that aligns, again, assuming there's a change of government, with issues of devolution, localism, economic growth, social growth, and such like. And we still don't seem to, as a sector, say, oi, we're here, we're these amazing institutions. We have these young people going through us, you know, a third to a half of the population go through us. Work with us because we can help deliver your broader agenda, because universities are a fundamental part of the social fabric of any country, and especially a country like the UK. And we need to change that narrative fundamentally.
Alex, obviously in the Lib Dem manifesto and in the Green manifesto, there's a commitment to bringing back maintenance grants. Let's speculate and guess that Labour might at least commit to looking at that. It's certainly, Bridget Phillipson has certainly hinted at that in the past through twiddles with the student loan system. Although it's kind of notable, isn't it, that nobody says how much they would be, how many there would be, who they would go to, and so on.
The sort of normalized crisis that we're seeing in the sector with living costs going up is meaning that more and more students are struggling. I mean, we're seeing that with uptake on our bursaries at the university. We're seeing that with students dropping out, and we're seeing that with housing prices going up too. So I think some clarity there would be really useful. But when it comes to the Labour Party more widely, I struggle to see what would change significantly for students and for universities. Starmer himself has admitted that the current system is unfair and that it doesn't work for students, doesn't work for universities. But what that's going to mean beyond some sort of flimsy promise of a review, I'm not entirely sure. I think their big argument for young people and students will be that stability has changed, we're going to grow the economy, and that in the big picture, that'll mean you get a house sooner and you should be happy about it.
Unless we bring in rent controls for student landlords, all that a maintenance grant is going to be is an increased gift from the Treasury to student landlords, because rents will go up in line with maintenance grants. Like, that is like, and there is nothing to stop that. There's no like control, cap, anything. So I think we need to be really careful about giving students more money, knowing that it would just hemorrhage out to their landlords.
But Sunday, more broadly, that's interesting, isn't it? Because those on low incomes that are young, that are kind of under 30, to some extent, there's some material in the manifestos that we've seen so far. The Tories actually have an interesting record on the minimum wage, and there are some specific commitments on universal basic income in the Greens manifesto. But generally, these don't feel like a set of proposals in an election that are designed or conscious of what is going on for the young.
No, exactly. And also, this is all focused on money going in, right? It's not looking at money going out. And I'll talk a little bit about this later in this student academic survey, but I did some interviews with students around the cost of living on a piece of work with Pearson that's going to be published on Monday. And students would describe large sums of money that they could get from like their paid work, from their student loan. And they describe it as like water running through their fingers. Like, it's not actually staying in the students' pockets because of the cost of living, because of like high rent. So yeah, it just comes back to this thing of like, we have to look at the realities of what is going on in students' lives and the financial pressures that they're facing. And I've got, just going to put another bid in for rent controls, for student rent controls, because that's, again, going back to the Greens manifesto, there was quite a lot on housing, which is great to see if, you're a graduate or a young person trying to buy your first house, as Alex said, but nothing on student accommodation. And that's where a lot of the tension is at the minute.
Now, Jonathan, obviously, student unions have been working very hard with their universities to get students registered to vote, but the Duke of Edinburgh Award this week put research out that said only 4 in 10 of under 25s eligible to vote are likely to cast their ballot at the next general election. Should that worry us, or is that kind of inevitable given the content of the campaigns?
Bit of both, I guess. I think I like to see those data longitudinally. And I'm a great supporter of compulsory voting, so I would encourage everybody to vote. I think that's part of your democratic responsibility. And if you don't vote, I don't think you have an excuse to complain afterwards about what you get. I'm a great believer that people should vote. Those numbers are slightly different to the numbers coming out of the Advance HE survey that we're going to talk about in a minute, which had higher levels of voter registration up in the 80s, but still quite low levels of intention to vote, but not as low as what you just cited, Jim. I know Citizens UK, for example, have been running a university-based campaign trying to encourage students to register and vote. And I guess the timing of the election in July probably means that the majority of students are going to vote in their where they live as opposed to where they study. So there may be some advantage in seeing a greater turnout in that context as well. But I guess time will tell.
Alex, one of the things I'm always struck by when we go on our little sojourns around Europe in January is that Lots of the students' unions and associations we talk to say that, you know, all of the major political parties tend to have a youth agenda and a youth manifesto. And, you know, is the fact that we kind of don't have anything like that about First Past the Post, or is it a failure in the political parties to really substantially engage young people? I mean, you know, what is going on? Why is it that the whole election feels like it's aimed at a particular age bracket that, you know, students generally don't fall into?
Well, I think it's both of those things, to be completely honest with you. We do seem to go on this cycle of the major political parties offering nothing to students not turning out, and then that cycle continues. So there's clearly something that needs to be done, and it does start with greater voter registration. I know the NUS are working on a turn up campaign. I'm sure My Life, My Say are doing similar things, but I do think there's a real point about proportional representation being a huge step in the right direction if it was something that was ever introduced. I mean, we do see smaller political parties offering a lot more to young people because potentially that's where some of their vote share lies. So we've got to make ourselves as open and as big a group as possible if we're ever going to be on the main agendas of political parties.
Yeah, just somewhat ironically, I think there's a strong likelihood that you're going to see the Conservatives and Reform arguing for PR in the next parliament.
yeah, who'd have thought it? Now, just before we finish all of this, Sunday, notable, I think, that the Lib Dems had statutory duty of care in there.
Yeah, so this is all down to the efforts of the Learn Network, I believe, who had been canvassing at various party conferences last year, mid last year, I can't remember what is time. This is going to be an interesting one to watch. Again, it's something that the campaign group are continuing to lobby all parties on. It's something that Robert Halfen obviously took to a Westminster Hall debate, but it's sort of the issue sort of remains stagnant from there. So it'll be really interesting to see where this goes.
Yes, and of course, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that the Lib Dems could become the official opposition. So interesting stuff. Plenty of manifesto analysis on the site. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Ruairi Cullen. Earlier this week, I wrote about the state of media, screen, journalism and communication studies in UK higher education for Wonky, following the latest report in the British Academy's State of the Discipline series. My three key takeaways are, first, these subjects are popular. There was a 6% increase in undergraduates and a 72% rise in taught postgraduate degrees between 2012 and 2021. Second, we can see regional disparities emerging, with 45% of postgraduate taught students attending institutions in London and the South East. This has the potential to pose an array of challenges, not least in undermining one of these subjects' key strengths, disciplinary and institutional diversity. Finally, ensuring the sustainability of this field is crucial. These subjects are often at the forefront of the challenges posed by technological advancements and increasing digitalization. They are an investment in a healthy and functioning society, underpinning the UK's creative sectors, which have grown at 1.5 times the rate of the UK economy over the past decade.
Now, next up this week, HEPI and Advance HE's annual student academic experience survey is out, and everything's getting better, Jonathan.
Well, just a bit of context before we dive into the results. So this is an annual survey of undergraduates that's been running for 18 years. It's also a very large survey with over 10,000 respondents, and this means that you can look at trends over time, but as well as some detailed subgroup analysis. I think that, you know, this was a sort of classic survey of, as we've already hinted at, of glass half full, glass half empty, and it depends where you come from. So for those optimists, you know, the good news here is that there's a sustained 3-year improvement post-COVID on perceived value for money of courses from undergraduates, and probably more importantly, across 7 domains around teaching quality or perceived teaching quality, these are all up. And actually, I think, you know, I think we can be slightly dismissive of that. But given the context within which HE has been operating over the last 12 months, I do think that should be a shout out to the sector, and especially those lecturers on the front line who are delivering that increased teaching quality. on the other side, for the pessimists, there's some quite shocking data, I think, around paid employment. So over half of students are now in some form of paid employment. And the average, and let me stress the word the average here, is they're doing 14.5 hours a week, which, let's just put that into our heads, that's 2 days a week on top of your full-time studies. And as the report demonstrates, and as we've already discussed, this is clearly linked to the cost of living crisis and the real term cuts in the maintenance grant. So I think that is a real challenge for the sector. And then finally, and as you wrote this morning, Jim, on Wonky, there are some really important differences by different groups. And, so for example, some of the trend data by country is interesting, as well as breaking it down by caring responsibilities, ethnicity, sexual identities, and such like. So, as with all surveys, it is those that sort of when you cut the data that you get into the interesting stuff. But overall, the positive here is that we are seeing perceived improvements in teacher quality, which I think is quite amazing given the context. But the fact that students on average are doing 2 days a week paid work on top of their full-time studies is a completely shocking statistic.
Yes. Alex, I mean, funnily enough, Alex, actually, so ages and ages and ages ago when OFS was kind of being launched, and I was kind of doing leading some research on value for money for OFS. When we published it and we showed that satisfaction with Scottish value for money wasn't, 100%. A load of people were kind of commenting, on the socials going, well, this doesn't make any sense. Students in Scotland get everything for free and so on. And I was saying, look, if you look at it, value for money isn't just about what you pay. It's also about your ability to take advantage of the stuff. And I guess one of the stories in the survey is lots and lots of students are really, really struggling to take advantage of university.
No, precisely. And there are a number of reasons for that. As Jonathan pointed to, there's a large number of students working on reasonable hours outside of their education. And I think another thing that's worth mentioning is one of the big conversations happening at universities at the moment isn't around value for money. It's about efficiency and how courses can be taught for as little as possible, with terrible staff student ratios, making money and not putting the student experience first, or at least that's how it's read in my eyes. So my concern is that we'll be heading in the wrong direction if there isn't significant investment in universities. And a lot of this does come down to political choice. It was a political choice to treble tuition fees, a political choice to remove maintenance grants, to not increase loans in line with inflation. And it's always students who pay the price. And it has been throughout the cost of living crisis too. So my hope is that a Labour government are bold enough to start investing in the sector, but then universities are bold enough to switch their agenda away from solely looking at efficiency and making money and start focusing again on what works for students.
Sunday, I didn't put much of this in the main blog this morning, but one of the things that was kind of really shocking, actually. So when I was kind of going through the Excel sheet, on the kind of far right hand side, there's a sample of care experience students and a sample of estranged students. And, add the two up and it's, substantial enough once it's appropriately weighted and so on. And they are having a really rotten time. They're working longer hours than anybody else. They're, much more likely to have been affected by the cost of living crisis and so on. And it's that sharp end that, the report illustrates, isn't it?
So this is really interesting, actually, because I'm just picking up on what you're asking, but also on what Jonathan said around paid work. I'm not surprised at all that 50% of students are in paid work. I actually thought it would be a bit higher. What I would like to know is what kind of work and what kind of demographics of students are doing that work, because when I did these interviews with students, I would be talking to, wealthy, sometimes privately educated students who would tick that little box in the academic experience survey to say that they're doing paid work. But the difference was that it was discipline adjacent work, or it was degree relevant work. They were getting internships, or they were getting placements with so-and-so's law firm. And then you would talk to the exchange students, the care experience students, and also some international students as well were saying this because they didn't have the networks here to use. They were doing things like cleaning. Nothing wrong with cleaning. Cleaners make this country go round, but that's not why they're at university. And they would often say to me that they felt that they were substituting, you know, their degree and their long-term career goals for short-term cash in a job that wasn't degree relevant. So I think it's really important that we look at not just that students are doing paid work, but what type of paid work is accessible to those groups of students as well. And I think you might have said this in your piece this morning. I was doing a lot of reading this morning. But yeah, there's almost like a piece of work here for universities and SUs to be saying like, okay, the reality is now that students have to have some kind of income, some kind of paid income in order to make ends meet while they're studying. How can we make that as worth their while, as degree relevant, you know, contributing to their transferable skills as possible? The other thing that I actually wanted to point out as well was, and this is also to do with like breaking stuff down. So looking at which demographics wanted to drop out and which demographics didn't, 60% of all students said that they weren't considering dropping out. And I really, really need to stress this. Not considering dropping out does not mean that you're having a good time. And I specifically talk about this in relation to care experience students, in relation to exchange students, in relation to students from a low socioeconomic background. Because when I ask these students, do you consider dropping out? They look at me with such bewilderment that I would even consider asking that question. And the reason being is that it's a sunken cost fallacy or a sunken cost approach, right? So students from low socioeconomic backgrounds would say, or care experience who have no family network or exchange students, what other choice do I have? This is how I've been told to escape precarity. Why would I even think about dropping out, you know? And international students do make similar arguments. So they say, well, I've paid X amount of fees, transported myself across the world, paid a year upfront housing. Am I going to drop out? No. And on top of this as well, there's a sort of emotional pressure. So students from low socioeconomic backgrounds sometimes say that there's a lack of support for their academic endeavours, or there's a scepticism from their working class community. And they say to drop out would be to sort of, you know, prove everyone right at home. Or international students say their families have thrown all their savings to get them at UK university, and to drop out would betray that. So yeah, there is a stubborn level of resilience amongst students in that 60% who are saying that they're not dropping out. And I have to say that we cannot assume that those who are not considering dropping out from these marginalized demographics have not considered dropping out because they're having a great time. There are psychological and emotional pressures and incentives to stay at university. And we need to be really careful about extrapolating any positive interpretations from this.
Yes, it's a little bit like whenever someone says, look at how low the UK's dropout rate is. And I'm like, yeah, well, no one traps students in higher education like the UK does. Jonathan, one of the things that I guess hasn't had much attention on the HEPI site or whatever, but that I really, really enjoyed was towards the back of the main report where some quite whizzy free text analysis has been done on what students say would improve things, right? And, you know, I was particularly kind of interested in their views on curriculum. So they want academic activity that's relevant, practical, and connected to the real world, more practical context-specific learning through real-world examples, assessments that engage and enhance employability, work-integrated learning, industry collaborations. There's a lot in there about the real world coming through from students that feels like it's in contrast to what they're experiencing. Which, you know, the report paints this picture of students experiencing something that's much more theoretical. Is there something in there that the sector can work on that's in its gift in this kind of terrible kind of funding crisis we've got?
Yeah, well, and I think it goes back to what Sunday was just talking about the what is the nature of the work people are doing. If we have a student population, and I'm going to keep on saying this word on average, because I like to see the range of this at working 2 days a week, And if they are working in McDonald's, and I choose McDonald's because that's how I funded my university degree, that, you know, that's fine from a financial point of view, but it's not fine from a learning point of view. But if they're doing university funded jobs or other jobs which are related to their degree, then that can be a good real world experience. So I do think that, in the sort of context of a cost of living crisis, there's quite a lot of exciting innovation that universities are and could continue to do in terms of connecting sort of paid employment and supporting students financially with their desire to have more real world experience. So there, you know, there's undoubtedly an opportunity there. Something that, you know, I think sort of nimble and progressive universities are already embracing and will continue to embrace.
Now, Alex, let me put you on the spot. You are an education officer in the Russell Group. And, therefore, you know, you've probably got things to say about teaching and teaching styles and teaching quality. One of the really interesting things in the report, I thought, was that if you compare the mission groups, the Russell Group comes out worst on staff motivated you to do your best work, were helpful and supportive, clearly explained course goals and requirements, regularly initiated debates, and helped you explore your own areas of interest. Now, is that because students in the Russell Group are kind of have higher expectations and are really demanding? Or is there something going on with, you know, the kind of quality of teaching in the Russell Group? What's happening?
That's a very good question. I imagine that there is something around expectations and people coming to the Russell Group expecting a certain standard of teaching, a certain staff to student ratio, and when you don't get that, it's very difficult. One of the big conversations we've been having at Exeter is around the timeliness of feedback and the quality of feedback. We've had some really interesting insights there, with students saying they'd prefer to have good quality feedback rather than feedback come quickly. And that there's actually quite an interesting statistic in the report saying that just 6 in 10 students said that they got feedback in time for it to be useful for their next assignment. And I think the word useful there is very important. It's all well and good having that feedback come back quickly, but it has to mean something, and it has to be able to lead to a tacit improvement there. But I'm sure there are a multitude of reasons. I think the sort of efficiency point I was making earlier is probably one of those as well.
I guess the other thing that's caught the eye of some of the press this morning, Sunday, is AI. So of those who never use AI in their studies, their total hours in work and study average 38. But for those using AI tools on a daily basis, their total average hours in study and work are 50 a week. Now, what is this telling us?
I would say that this is indicative of subject. So like computer-based subjects are more likely to be using AI at a higher rate than, say, humanities subjects. That being said, I really think that there needs to be a bit more exploration around this, because if competent use of AI is to be built into curriculums, then I would expect students across the board to be using AI, to be being taught it, to use it well and effectively, because AI is and will be present in the industries that students are going to graduate into. And that's from publishing all the way to medicine, right? And this is something that's come up time and time again. I talk about medicine because I've been involved in medical curriculum development, but competent use of AI in medical diagnostic work is a really important skill to use. And again, I know medicine sits within sort of STEM subjects, and I know that higher use of AI is in STEM subjects, but I'm really interested to see like what people are going to be doing with these stats. Like, what is the interpretation of these stats? Because AI is not going away, right? AI is going to be present within the workplaces that students are going to be graduating into. And if we want a work-ready graduate base with work-ready skills, then absolutely absolutely AI should be featuring highly on a lot of curriculums and in a lot of students' learning timetables.
Jonathan, one of the things I definitely like to look at every year when this comes out is regret. You know, we have actually, if you compare to other countries, we have quite a high level of regret, either about the institution a student has been to or the course they've been to, and so on. And, you know, what is there something we can do about students feeling that when they graduate, you know, 4 in 10 of them are saying they made the wrong choice somehow?
Yeah. Well, I think it gets, I mean, I think there are a number of issues there, aren't there, Jim? So I think the first one, it gets to your earlier point about, you know, we lock students in given the funding scheme we have. So it's very hard if a student feels regret early on to actually do anything about that. And I guess that psychologically that regret's going to increase. And also I think there's just something about the fundamental sort of early specialization of education in this country, which probably drives to a degree, levels of regret, because you find topics that you suddenly realize that you may wish to have studied, that you couldn't have studied because you followed a different A-level route, into university. And again, finally, I think it gets to the, broader, almost political issue about if there are lots of graduates out there who regretted, either part going to university or what they did when in university, that adds, if you like, to the political, sort of conversation around the role of universities and the value of universities in society. So again, something for universities to focus on. But as I said earlier, a lot of this, I think, gets back to the sort of the public narrative around what are universities and what's our role in society. And I think we got that slightly misplaced at the moment. Can I just raise one other issue which caught my eye, which was the question around freedom of speech? Which was remarkably similar to last year's student satisfaction survey, and basically says for a large majority of students, they don't feel that student freedom of speech is an issue. They feel comfortable in expressing their views and such like, which backs up lots of other data. Now, clearly, people have argued that it's not about the majority, it's about the minority, and I take that point, but again, from, you know, given all the heat we've had around freedom of speech over the last 5 years, it's not an issue that concerns the vast majority of students.
But just on that, Jonathan, when you do the splits, I mean, you know, fair enough, the HEPI Advanced HE Academic Experience Survey doesn't measure whether or not people are left wing or right wing, or, you know, so we can't see correlations there. But to the extent to which we have got anything in here, it's black and minority ethnic students that are much less likely to, you know, feel confident to express themselves. Disabled students much less likely to feel confident to express themselves. And that's not the caricature that gets painted, is it?
No, exactly. And that's what I was saying about the minority of students. But the headline data, what struck me was how remarkably similar this was to the student satisfaction survey and previous surveys on the issue. But what, based on some work I did years ago now, so it may be dated, we did find that students with right-wing leanings felt less comfortable expressing their views. So you're absolutely right, the different socio-demographic characteristics here are not ones you would necessarily expect given previous research. So something worth sort of focusing in on in more detail, I guess.
And then, Alex, just one other thing before we come off this. 7 in 10 students are lonely every day or every week if they've been impacted by the cost of living crisis a lot. But if they've not been impacted by it at all, only 4 in 10 are lonely daily or weekly. Surely that is in our gift to turn around.
Yeah, absolutely. Both when we talk about government and university, there's a lot to be done there. And I think there's also something to be said there about cohort rebalancing and the fact that the number of commuter students is raising rapidly at a lot of universities. I mean, I was really pleased to see the guidance for the Access and Participation Plan now recommending clear steps to support commuter students. But there's a lot of work to be done there, and you're absolutely right. right that it is in universities' hands, but it's an issue that not enough is being done. And I definitely think the student unions too should be working with their universities there.
Yeah, going to campus is like going to the cinema on your own with similar prices for the catering. good. Now, plenty more on the site on the Happy Academic Experience, Happy Advanced HE Academic Experience Survey. Now, as you may know, we've been looking back over the years to previous decades' manifestos.
Hi, I'm Adam Matthews, Senior Research Fellow at the University of Birmingham. Debbie McVitie and I are continuing our analysis of general election manifesto texts from 1945 to 2019. This week, it's the 1980s. After gaining power in May 1979, Margaret Thatcher led the country until 1990. Thatcher herself and the free market small government philosophy that she advocated and implemented are still highly divisive and polarising for many. However, reading the manifesto texts of 1983 and 1987 of the three main parties shows surprising consensus when it comes to higher education. Things weren't good for Britain at the start of the decade. Factories were closing, unemployment rocketed, and social unrest was breaking out all over the country. Britain was dubbed the sick man of Europe. Overwhelmingly, there was cross-party consensus that universities and tertiary education was part of the solution back to economic prosperity. The how and the what is where we find some divergence. The Labour Party called for a tertiary awards council and more places and extra funding. The Conservatives looked to switch to a greater focus on technology, science and engineering with greater efficiency on spending. For Thatcher, there was no alternative. A shock therapy that involved an individualism and entrepreneurial approach to the economy and culture was the way forward. Critics say that competition and efficiency was prioritised over social cohesion. Thatcher famously said herself that there was no such thing as society. The 1983 election put socialist ideals up against free markets and competition. The Conservative Party were victorious, and the Labour Party manifesto was described as the longest suicide note in history. Victory came again for Thatcher in 1987, and again universities were described as key players in national prosperity and were asked to put research and scholarship to practical and applied use for success in international markets. You can read my article in full on the site.
Now, finally this week, students flirting with staff has been all over the news, Alex.
Oh, well, a lot of this stems from the news that at the University of Cambridge, students have been warned over behaviour that staff may see to be flirtatious, which has inevitably led to wider discussions around those staff-student relationships. We've seen a broad range of opinion, even among students, with a student telling the Times that some form of relationship building with teachers is part of university life and that stricter rules clamping down on staff-student relationships may not actually make that much difference. But on the flip side, another former Cambridge student made the case that such relationships are often built on an unbalanced and exploitative power dynamic, and that the university's decision to ban student-staff relationships actually makes a lot of sense. But Cambridge aren't the only university to have taken the step. But there are still many who share the IFS's expected view that the registering of these relationships goes far enough. So the debate isn't really whether or not there are deeply problematic student-staff relationships that have existed and do continue to exist due to exploitation and slanted power dynamics, but there's definitely disagreement on where to draw that line regarding the protection of students and the sort of clash with their private lives.
Yes, I mean it's interesting this, I think, days, literally days after the manifesto, after the general election was called, we were due to get OFS's decision on its consultation. It's been running since January 2023 on whether to register or ban staff-student relationships. And, you know, the fact that, you know, Rishi Sunak called the election means that another academic year has kind of gone on that. But, you know, I get the sense that there isn't really a kind of settled view on this around the sector, Jonathan.
Well, yes, I think there is a settled view around principles, in the sense that staff-student relationships are likely to include actual or perceived abuse of power and therefore should be avoided as much as one can. Whether you go as far as banning them or registering them is a implementation issue. But I think the headlines this week came from Cambridge University and its guidance, to quote the tabloids, ban on flirting. And I think here I'm slightly uncomfortable with this, not because I'm uncomfortable with the principle, but the idea that the onus is being put on the students, who clearly have lesser power in this situation, is almost sort of victim blaming. It's not quite victim blaming, but it's getting close to victim blaming. I can't put my finger on it, but it just makes me feel slightly uncomfortable that it's up to the students to stop flirting rather than professional staff members to act professionally.
Sunday, LBC the other night, big call in, actually quite a similar story about BP managers being told that they can't strike up relationships with staff. And, you know, I mean, the actual phone in was fairly miserable, but obviously, you know, but both in the BP thing and actually in Cambridge's policy, there's stuff in there about, you know, there being either a banner or a register of these sorts of things where there's a direct supervisory relationship. Now, I know Sunday that you have views that would suggest that that doesn't go far enough.
To answer your question, Jim, absolutely. You know, this idea that we are still sage on a stage working environment for students, where the only way they could possibly ever have any kind of institutional impact on a student at the SAFCAN is through teaching them, is so underwhelmingly like ignorant, right? Like, of course, members of staff represent the institution to students when they come into contact with them, staff who work in pastoral roles, staff who work in all sorts of roles. It's also, you know, taking that view is relying on the student to understand the inner workings of a university, to understand how power is distributed, to understand hierarchies and structures and networks. And particularly for widening participation of first generation students, particularly if they've gone through a school system where, you know, they've been told this is how you behave, you know, you respect your teachers, you respect members of staff. They're not necessarily going to know that that member of staff can't impact their ability to do X, Y, Z, can't impact their grades, can't impact whatever. And then the other point is, which again blows my mind that people don't understand this, is anyone who's worked in an office knows that there is office gossip, right? Anyone who's worked in a department has struck up friends with other people in that department. I would not want to be being taught by the best friend or a close friend or even an acquaintance of someone who I feel has abused their power over me, right? Like, even in that sense, there's still going to be an impact there. So the very real sort of human psychology around this is completely overlooked, and the vulnerability in which students bring to the institution is overlooked as well. I think the other thing that's quite annoying about the conversation around this, particularly in that Times piece, is that the author hadn't actually had a relationship with a member of staff, right? She had just fantasized about one. And that included a sort of starry-eyed pondering that if she had managed to sort of have a relationship with him, she could be engaged by the end of her degree. Now, I'm not going to go off on how women don't go to university to find marriage. That's, you know, that's a whole other argument. But then she alludes to fictional academic characters from Netflix series. And it's exactly this romanticized type of view that these relationships have that frustrate me and obscure the data that we have on this, right? Because it's the fantasy that is thrown at us every single time that, you know, these women want these, and it is, sorry, it is usually young women, by the way. Obviously, there are all kinds of like configurations of these relationships, but it tends to be young women coming forward in the data. But then when we, you know, we compare that sort of like romantic fantasy of finding your wife at university or finding your husband at university, and it was that kind of like lovable rogue academic, and it was a meeting of two intellectual minds. All the studies find that even when the student who participates in those relationships and consents in those relationships and is they themselves bought into that fantasy, studies show that in retrospect, okay, they describe them, and I quote from participants in this study, extremely exploitative, harmful, they feel betrayed and used. I've got a little theory on this, if you do indulge me for a couple moments more. My theory around this, particularly around and again, I'm gendering this, I know that I'm gonna get a bit backlash because I'm gendering this, but the stats do show that it tends to be young women and older men. We don't ever frame male role models for women outside of romantic interest. We don't do that. We don't have male role models for girls outside of romantic interest. So fictional or not, if a young woman and an older man have some kind of like working relationship, there's always an assumption that they're shagging, and we need to move away from that.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to keep you and where you work ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do pop over to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Jonathan, Alex, Sunday, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky. We'll